In the 1750s, the white settlers of the area that would become Pittsburgh started mining into the hillside and struck coal. Bituminous coal deposits were abundant and just below the ground. In fact, the hillside across from Fort Pitt was first called Coal Mountain. The coal mines in proximity to the river put this area at an advantage. It was much easier to mine the coal and cart it a few hundred yards down the hillside to barges than in other industrializing areas where the coal had to be carted miles to the nearest river or canal. The Edgar Thomson Steel Plant, built by Carnegie, McCandless and Company in 1874, came about as a result of this combination of coal and river transport.
As the coal mining and steel industry increased production, the air quality began to decline. At the time, in the late 1800s, pollution of the environment was not viewed as a negative effect. Many saw smoky skies as a sign of progress and prosperity. However, many also opposed it.
In the 1880s, the gas industry expanded rapidly, if only for a short while. After building a well on his property, George Westinghouse drilled into an extremely high-pressure gas deposit, which is estimated to be flaring at over 20 million cubic feet of gas per day. When the emerging gas industry caught wind of high-pressure wells in the region, it launched Pittsburgh into a decade-long gas boom, which reduced air pollution as steel and other industries transitioned to gas as an industrial fuel. However, gas didn't stay long in Pittsburgh, primarily driven by the steel industry's movement back to coal for its economy and stability of supply. Additionally, oil and gas deposits began to dry up in western Pennsylvania.
But the railroad and river infrastructure that supported coal, steel, and other heavy industries remained. In the 1940s, during the war effort, Pittsburgh's steel output ballooned, including production at Edgar Thomson Steel Plant in Braddock. This marked the beginning of a 20-year period of the worst polluted and smoky days in Pittsburgh history.
The 1960s saw the rise of the environmental movement, marked at the national level with the signing of the Clean Air Act in 1963 and the establishment of the EPA in 1970.
By this time, the steel industry in the region was beginning to decline for a wide range of reasons, from reduced steel demand to a more competitive global economy. After decades of investing in infrastructure and supplying union jobs, albeit often with exploitative labor practices, the steel industry shrank to a shell of what it once was.
Yeah, thank you again, everybody, for coming out. This is panels on how the essential dirty steel industry is going green. I'm Maria Gallucci. I'm a senior reporter for Canary Media, a nonprofit newsroom. To my right is Edith Abeda. As I mentioned, is a community advocate, resident in North Braddock, Pennsylvania, which is where U.S. Steel's Edgar Thomson Steelworks is based. That's what we just saw in the video. Chatu Gamage is a principal with the Climate Aligned Industries Program at RMI, which is a clean energy nonprofit. And as a disclaimer, Canary Media for now is an independent affiliate of RMI. And Hillary Lewis is the steel director at Industrious Labs, which is an organization focused on industrial decarbonization. Well, I think it's an interesting time to be having this panel. I feel like steel has been in the news maybe more recently, especially kind of in the context of green steel, reducing emissions. The reason we're focusing on this material is one, it is essential, it's ubiquitous. The world makes about 2 billion metric tons of steel a year for buildings, bridges, roads. It's in our houses and appliances and cookware. At the same time, it's one of the most, if not the most, carbon-intensive industries in the world, responsible for about 9% of global CO2 emissions every year. And that's on top of all of the toxic air pollution that steelmaking produces, which can increase the risk of heart disease, of cancer, asthma. So to get us started, I wanted to kick it off to Hillary, actually, if you could talk us through a bit about sort of traditional coal-based steelmaking, how that process works, and what it looks like in the United States.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm so sorry that I was late, but it's great to be here. So steel today is mostly made, about 70% globally, is made in coal-based furnaces called blast furnaces. We actually only have 13 left in the United States. It used to be the predominant form of steel making, but now we use electric arc furnaces that are primarily run on scrap, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later. But coal-based furnaces essentially have three ingredients: iron ore, which is mostly mined in Minnesota, coal, which used to come from Appalachia, and then a little bit of lime. And so I like to use a margarita analogy because I was like, lime, that's something you put in a margarita. And so, you can, I think that's a memorable way to think about what's in it. And I think the ratio is like about the same. It's like not that much lime, but there's like a little squeeze of lime. And then you have the coal and the iron ore. And the reason why you need coal is because when you mine iron ore, it comes out with some oxygen attached to it, and you need to remove that oxygen. And so the carbon from the coal bonds with the oxygen and makes carbon dioxide. And the lime also helps, but in like a fun way. And these furnaces, as Maria mentioned, also have a lot of health-harming air pollutants associated with them, and that primarily comes from coal. So that's why we're really focused on getting coal out of steelmaking.
Thanks, Edith. I wanted to ask if you could talk a bit about what it's like for you and for the community in a living near a facility like the one Hillary just described.
So I'm gonna spend a little bit of time. So if everybody could be patient with me talking about this, because I feel like it's the part that's my expertise. So I live in North Braddock, less than a mile from Edgar Thomson Steelworks, which is some of the mill that we were talking about in the video. I am 58 years old. I am Latinx. I'm an artist. I don't have a family. I do have a husband. I think my experience parallels a lot of my neighbor's experience, but not all. So it's a really complicated, complex history, contemporary issue. And so I don't want people to walk away thinking that, okay, this is what it's like to live next to a steel mill based only on what I'm going to tell you. And I think because I've been involved in struggles with US Steel since the end of 2013, my position has also changed. And my, I guess, ability to take risks is also much greater than a lot of my neighbors. So, everybody that lives adjacent to US Steel, it occupies four municipalities. For people not familiar with Allegheny County, which is the largest city in it, is Pittsburgh. There's a little more than 130 municipalities, most of which are about 1 square mile. So at one time in the 1920s, the population density and the housing density was actually greater than Manhattan at the same time. So I think Hillary's had the pleasure to come and visit. And you would never know this is the case. So if I had to say, I thought about what's my elevator speech? Right, you all are journalists, right? You need these sound bites. I would say, just imagine what it would be like to be gaslit 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I would say that sort of summarizes what it's like to live next to a steel mill. And then other observations that I'd like to share. I think as an advocate, you spend a lot of time speaking to a lot of people that you don't know, and generally they don't necessarily want to see you or hear from you. So getting on calls in sort of like a crisis timeline, right? Maybe someone was just able to schedule a meeting with the White House, Office of Management and Budget, or the CEQ, and then organizing around that and getting phone calls as to what are you going to say as a community member in regards to the iron steel making regulations that the EPA is reviewing right now, or the coke oven regulations that the EPA is reviewing now. And I just wanted to describe a little bit of the street that I live on. I think it's an exceptional one in Pittsburgh, which is a highly, highly segregated place. So I live there. I've been living there for about 10 years. My neighbor across the street is a third generation. His house that's across the street from where he lives now is in total collapse and decay. His father grew up there. The neighbor next to me, it's a family that moved during the pandemic from Ohio. It was a house that if anyone saw it, it would totally be a teardown, but a contractor at the time moved in and rebuilt this thing from scratch and sold it for $150,000 during the pandemic. They also drive a Tesla. So this is very different than my experience where, you know, we bought a house for $29,000 that you could move into, built in the late 19th century. There are people who are living, who moved there from Oaxaca, who have been systematically basically purchasing houses and rebuilding them. They are roofing contractors. It's a great skill to have when there's lots of houses that are condemned and abandoned and decaying. There's a trans family that lives there. And so they recently had children and regularly have to test their children for lead poisoning, which is a big issue in Southwest PA, not only in terms of water, but also ET kind of rains down lead on us, right? So lead and other heavy metals. I think another way to describe what it's like to live there is that you could put the prefix DIS in front of almost any word and that would describe it. So I did use dystopic, which is not, that's technically with the Y, but disinvested, disrepair, disregarded, disillusioned, disgusted. And there seems to be little hope for any change. Yet I would say that the majority of the neighbors that I know they feel and believe that this is their home. They love it. And they have a lot of ideas about how it could be different. And so thinking about it in terms of green steel, right? Like how can we get U.S. Steel, who's been there for 150 years, to change their practices and what they have now? And then just in case I don't want to assume that everyone here is just like follows the steel industry regularly, like all of us do. But Nippon Steel has proposed to purchase U.S. Steel. And there's a lot of people pinning their hopes that because it's a different steel company, right, that things will get better. But if you also look at Nippon's track record, they're blast furnace operators. So they're, you know, they buy coke, right? So coke is made from coal, which we can also address a little bit about Clarendon Coke Works and what it's like for people who live there. I just want to say is that despite all the 15 decades of resistance that's been against U.S. Steel, whether it's labor, immigrants from Europe, contemporary advocates, activists, lawsuits, and a pretty big one that just got won a couple of months ago, like one of the biggest, I think the third biggest award in the nation. It's not changing. It's not changing for anyone. And I'll just leave it there.
thank you for sharing that. I think what you were kind of talking about too, sort of the disrepair, disinvestment in the community, also is reflecting sort of this interesting dynamic in the U.S. steel industry where there is still this very polluting, problematic kind of coal-based steelmaking industry. And at the same time, there is a lot of production of a different or kind of a different type of steel production that's happening in the United States in other regions. So kind of outside of the traditional Rust Belt, so to speak, and more in the South. And so, Chats, I wanted to ask you if you could speak about sort of this other component of U.S. steelmaking, which is sort of using recycled steel, using electric arc furnaces, why we're seeing more of that in the United States, and how that kind of compares globally.
Hey, everybody. I think the majority of the conversation when we talk about decarbonization has to sit with ore-based steelmaking. But as you're saying, Maria, on the other side, 70% of U.S. steel is made from a process called EAF, electric arc furnace.
Oh, is that better?
Slight pulse to you.
Hi. So as I was saying, 70% of U.S. steel is actually made from electric arc furnace, where you melt down scrap steel. And why this is preferred is because it's cheaper, because it's already made, right? Because it is scrap steel. And so when we think about the emissions reduction from that, it's 80% cleaner than this blast furnace steel. And we have a lot of it in the U.S. because of the stock and flow. Majority of folks in the U.S., you know, have multiple cars, there's constructions, there's buildings, and steel is an infinitely recyclable material. There is contaminants, but there is processes and things to get that out. And so it is a success in the sense that we have gotten technologies up to speed to do that. However, there is a cap at which we still need primary-based steelmaking for the quality and product. And so when we think about this, I guess, story that the U.S. is trying to say of nationally we're clean steel, that's sort of an averages game. And so when we think about the emissions perspective of that, 70%, the emissions are more like the 30% range. And so I think that's something to sort of hold and keep in mind. There is a path to decarbonize the EAF trajectory. It majority uses electricity to heat that down in terms of scrap. And so where there's initiatives going towards getting PPAs and essentially buying cleaner electricity, there's a pathway there. Whereas I'm sure we'll get into this, Maria, of like the difficulty essentially, as Hillary mentioned, of getting a reduction for that primary. And that's where the challenge lies.
Right. As you were saying, in the United States, 70% of steelmaking now comes from these sort of secondary sources, the melting down scrap, but the majority of the emissions and pollution still comes from that primary ore-based steelmaking. And I have a few infographics to show. I wish they were closer, but I'll put those up. And as I'm moving, Chats, would you mind kind of talking about, so when we think about green steelmaking, it seems like a lot of groups are kind of coalescing around this idea of it involving hydrogen. So could you talk about the role of hydrogen, how that kind of fits into steelmaking?
Yeah. So when we think about hydrogen, there's sort of two parts. So what Hillary touched on was the conversion of the blast furnace and the role that coal plays in that. That is for primarily the heat and also this reduction process of splitting up the iron ore. Excellent infographic behind me. And so what we're trying to do is essentially find a molecule that plays that same role. And that could be natural gas today that also is this DRI EAF furnace. The sort of the mystery behind that is all of the DRIs in the world today, and that, you know, we're operating that, we know how that's running, it already uses hydrogen that's from natural gas. And so the molecule of using a green hydrogen made with, you know, renewables and water really decarbonizes this whole process up to 90% in terms of emissions reduction. And so the takeaway message from this is it's already operating. We know how these things work in terms of assets. It's now about getting this green hydrogen to these places. And I'm sure a lot of folks know about, you know, the hubs and all of the incentives and money that's predominantly rolling around in the US for this type of ecosystem to be built. But in terms of numbers and scale, it is quite daunting. So when we think about scaling up in milestones, I think that's also something to not be sort of concerned about, in the sense of there's gigawatts that have been stated. So a typical steel plant, 2 million tons, we're talking about 2 gigawatts of electrolyzers, maybe double that, 4 gigawatts of renewables. And maybe a positive spin to think about this year, there's going to be, I think, predicted about 35 gigawatts of renewables planned to be built in the US. So when we think about context, there's a lot of, I guess, negative stats on just we can never get there and how can we never get there. But I think the scale of these industries from converting to fossil gas, as I say, in the DRI, clean hydrogen, is being done, and we'll probably get to this, and it's not kind of inconceivable even within the U.S.
Yeah, thanks. Now that leads into my next question for you, Hillary, about the Biden administration last week or a couple weeks ago announced up to $6 billion in awards for projects that reduce emissions from heavy industries. That includes up to $500 million each for two steelmakers who want to build the first hydrogen-based direct reduced iron plants in the United States. So, Hillary, could you talk about these, talk about kind of the details of the announcements and the significance of them?
Yeah, last Monday was a really exciting day. Met a pass by for a few of you, but it was my sixth wedding anniversary, which is the iron anniversary. And for the iron anniversary, my husband got me the first green iron plant in the U.S. So we can all applaud him for his great work. It was, yeah, a really exciting day because until last Monday, there were no planned green steel plants in the United States. Green, when I say green steel, I mean green iron that then becomes green steel with an electric arc furnace. So under the Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure law, there was $6.3 billion available on a competitive basis for industrial demonstration programs or projects. And so steel was competing for a piece of that pie, and they ended up getting a lot of great projects out of it. So there are two that I want to call your attention to that both got $500 million, as Maria mentioned. One is what I would say, full stop, is the first green iron plant in the United States. It's being developed by a Swedish company called SSAB using their hybrid technology, which is something they've piloted in northern Sweden. And they're now building their first commercial scale facility using that technology in Mississippi, of all places. And lots of people in Mississippi have asked me, why Mississippi? And I don't have like a great answer, but to give you some context about maybe why Mississippi, you kind of need two things now in order to build a green iron plant. You need access to iron ore, which they can get up and down the Mississippi River, either from Minnesota or up from Brazil, and you need access to renewable energy. And there's a green hydrogen hub, not a hub funded by the Department of Energy, but just another kind of hub from a company called Hystor that they already have a letter of intent from to provide the green hydrogen. And you know, it's kind of as Chats was saying, like that's going to be the big challenge moving forward is how much clean electricity, additional clean electricity is needed to power these new facilities. So that's one of the projects that's being funded. That's very exciting. And it will create jobs and like bring a new product to market. There's a second facility being planned under this investment opportunity, and that's from one of the two last blast furnace operators in the United States, Cleveland Cliffs. It's at their Middletown, Ohio existing furnace. So they have a blast furnace in Middletown, Ohio, and they got $500 million to convert it to a direct reduced iron furnace. This is particularly exciting because it's not just going to provide this new green product, but it's replacing a dirty product. And so we're going to get rid of a lot of this health harming air pollution and climate pollution and be able to transition this facility. Some things that were really notable about the announcement is that the company said it's going to save them $150 per ton of liquid steel to transition this facility. I think that that was probably based on natural gas prices, but part of the Inflation Reduction Act hydrogen hubs is to get green hydrogen to be a comparable price to natural gas. So potentially that could still be true in a green hydrogen scenario. They also said they're going to maintain all of the existing union jobs at the facility. They're represented by the machinists, and in fact grow the number of permanent jobs by, I believe, 170 jobs. And that's in addition to all the construction, temporary construction jobs that it will also create. This is a very exciting announcement, thinking about the transition, which is really what we need to see happening. The concern, the caveat, which is not small, is that this is being built as a hydrogen flexible facility, which means that it can start by running on any amount of gas and transition to running on any amount of hydrogen. And so there's both the concern that they won't ever actually transition to hydrogen, and this will just be a gas facility, which continues our reliance on fossil fuels, and or that they will transition to blue or some other color of hydrogen that continues our reliance on fossil fuels. And so like the brief aside on hydrogen colors, if you're not familiar, blue is made from natural gas with carbon capture. Green is made with 100% renewable energy. There's also pink made from nuclear, gold or white, which is naturally occurring, and probably a bunch of other colors that I don't remember. So the concern here is that they are near a hydrogen hub that doesn't have a ton of green hydrogen in it. And so how are we going to get in southwestern Ohio access to all the renewable energy needed to create the hydrogen to power this facility. So there's work to do there, but the investment that they made, to give credit to Cleveland Cliffs, which is not something I do very often, but to give them credit, is like what they are investing in, the furnace that is 100% hydrogen ready, is the big deal. And so that's something to be excited about this week.
Thanks, Hillary. Yeah, and another factoid I remember from a story I did is talking with one of the engineers who developed the direct reduced iron facilities. He said that if you use hydrogen made from fossil gas, or kind of like the non-green hydrogen, that could potentially be worse for the climate than just using fossil gas, as is done today, because of all the extra steps and energy expended to turn that gas into hydrogen. So yeah, there's definitely a lot. As you said, it seems like a really exciting announcement, but there's a lot of work, I imagine, to be done to kind of make sure it actually plays out as intended.
Yes.
And Edith, I'm curious what your if your perspective on sort of hydrogen-based steelmaking or hydrogen hubs more broadly, especially because a lot of these projects are being proposed kind of near your community. If there's anything that you're encouraged by or concerns that you might have about these projects.
Yeah, I just want to say there was a panel before this, and one of the panelists is in the room, not to call her out, about hydrogen. So we do, you know, there's definitely some more experts here. So a little bit about Edgar Thomson is, like, if you see it and you look at it, it looks like a junkyard, right? It's a dump. Like, and I'm not just saying like dirty, like, you know, trees are growing out of its roofs, and you would find it hard to believe that anything's really happening there. A few years ago, U.S. Steel had said, we're going to invest over $1 billion in the Mon Valley Works, which comprises three of the facilities. They did public outreach. They did all these things, and they canceled it and then bought a electric arc furnace in Arkansas that was not union based. So you can imagine that there's major trust issues around anything that U.S. Steel would say. And there's no evidence that they're interested in investing in Edgar Thomson whatsoever, despite consent decrees, despite numerous violations that they get dinged for all the time. So one of the people that's part of the grassroots community, that organization, whatever you want to call it, that I'm part of, is an engineer. And so 2 years ago, we started work to craft input for DOE's hydrogen hubs, right? They put requests for information out. And we started the process 2 years ago, really asking for transparency. And as someone mentioned during this hydrogen hub talk earlier, was, is it possible for the community to actually say no? That is never an option, right? Like, everybody's negotiating, but the community never gets to say no. Whether people think it's an informed position or it's not an informed position, we don't get to say no. They do talk to community members, but generally it's to elected representatives that are basically volunteers where I live. no professional elected reps in North Braddock. So what's my concerns? Well, how I got into this movement is that basically there was going to be a frack well placed at Edgar Thomson. There's a lot of fracked gas in Southwest PA. And so we just see hydrogen because there's so much natural gas there, methane gas there, right? Like, this is just a way to build more wells, right? Pollute more communities and keep the fossil fuel industry alive and well where we live. And then the last thing I'll say, thinking about carbon capture, is that there are already landmen going around Ohio trying to buy people's pore spaces. So P-O-R-E for carbon capture. And I, I am not following this information that much, but I can't imagine that there is already regulatory policies in place or anybody is caught up to what's going on.
Edith, do you mind if I interject? No, are you talking about the carbon capture project proposed at U.S. Steel?
No, there's no, as far as I'm aware, there's no carbon capture or hydrogen that's being proposed at Edgar Thomson. But like I said, we have spent 2 years meeting with DOE, taking them on tours, doing all kinds of stuff to try to input and emphasize community inclusion.
Yeah, and I was, I know it's at some point U.S. Steel had proposed or is considering developing some sort of carbon capture project at Edgar Thomson, right, to kind of capture the CO2 from the flue stream and potentially inject it underground. But they are also doing that at their steel mill in Gary, Indiana. And Hillary, I was going to ask, I know you have some thoughts, if you could share those thoughts on U.S. Steel's new initiative. It's like a $100 million project.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten over how funny I think this announcement is. So I can't say anything like with a straight face about it. But it's like the timing is just like too funny, because, you know, last week we got the first announcement about a green steel facility in the United States. And then 1 week later, U.S. Steel announced that like they're very excited to be investing in some carbon capture. It's not sequestration. It's actually carbon capture in use that will address less than 0.5% of the carbon emissions at their Gary Works facility and do nothing, of course, for the health harming air pollution. And I just felt like, what was the timing of that decision? Like, you know, what PR consultants were involved in putting out this release? So it's just not serious. It's not a serious approach to decarbonization. It completely ignores the health harming pollutants that could be addressed by a more meaningful investment. And it just shows that they're not taking a serious approach to their decarbonization strategy or goals, and that they're going to be, you know, less competitive in the future. So as Maria was mentioning, they're also, that's one pilot project at Gary Works. It's a like different technology that they're looking at Edgar Thomson, some sort of membrane. But both projects are very small. And kind of the hidden headline of the Gary announcement that I thought was very interesting is that, you know, they'd previously announced this MOU. And what was announced this week was that they're signing a 20-year agreement. But if you're signing a 20-year agreement for a carbon capture project, just the way the technology works, and chats, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you build it to the source, right? So like direct air capture, it could just be like next to the source. But carbon capture, you build it on to whatever the pollution is coming from, which means that they expect the blast furnace in Gary to be operating in 20 years. And that's 20 years from 2026. So in 2046, they were announcing that they are going to continue operating a coal-based furnace. And so for all of these reasons, a big joke.
Do you have anything to add on carbon capture?
Yeah, I mean, it's like second everything Hillary's saying, and maybe to take a step back on when you think about a blast furnace and all of the point sources, there's multiple, right? And I think the practicality from both a engineering standpoint of doing something retroactively on a plant that's been operating for multiple decades is also laughable. And then I think the end point of all of these things is saying, what is the efficiency of that carbon capture? And on a global perspective, I think lots of folks are familiar with now the prominence, and it should be, on the methane related emissions that come from both the coal use, as well as even if we transition over to gas as well, it adds another, I'm going to say about half a gigaton towards the steel number that you see today. And so that's quite a, you know, sort of an immense number when you think about just the silent outside of the boundary emissions that are also related to carbon capture.
Thanks. And I wanted to pivot now to kind of talk about sort of beyond the federal, the regulatory side, the consumer side. Maybe chats, just to keep going with you, if you could talk about a bit about sort of what are some like voluntary actions or ways in which supply chains and markets can kind of sort of drive the shift toward green steel, hydrogen-based steelmaking?
Yeah, I think this is more of on a positive note when we think about the supply chain for steel, so cars, buildings, etc., and now I guess the plethora of renewables as well that are coming online that all use steel-based products and aluminium and other sort of heavy metals, saying how can we use our buying power to indicate that we want cleaner, greener materials. And so things like Steel Zero, First Movers Coalition, and all these other organizations have gone and ask people to say, can you make a commitment on the purchasing? And this is tons of steel per year. So First Movers Coalition has a commitment. It's 10% of your purchase by 2030 has to be green, and it's green and has a definition. So it has a tons of CO2 per ton threshold. And what we're doing at RMI, and there's other folks as well, are then saying, how do you convert those commitments into offtake and actually partnering up, aggregating that demand, and then sending that signal to the producers? And all of this is around business case and how do you make the economics work for a producer? Because there is still, even with, you know, what's on the table with IRA and Bill and all of these other incentives, there's still a gap when we think about the price of a green steel tonnage versus a blast furnace or a natural gas-based product. And so where folks want to be first movers, they want to pay a premium for that. How do you collect that volume and make that new investment in a green steel facility? And so there's those voluntary markets that are coming into play. And then there's also things that federally folks are doing as well in terms of buy clean policies for cement and steel as, you know, infrastructure projects in the government. They're buying, you know, I think more than 50% of the cement and steel for transportation projects and things like that. So we think about how can the risk be reduced from government entities coming into these purchases as well. So where you can pair up voluntary and public procurement to do these, as I said, millions of tons per plant, no one buyer is buying all of that. So there is this partnership angle that we need to bring in to make the business case work and get these projects to final investment decision.
Hillary, Industrious Labs works a lot with automakers, and Industrious Labs and its partner groups work a lot with automakers and EV makers in particular. Could you talk a bit about sort of why those industries or those sectors are potentially ideal candidates for kind of driving this demand?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about the automotive sector in the United States is that they're the biggest consumer of blast furnace steel today. So fully a third of all sales from blast furnaces in the United States go to the automotive industry. They have enormous purchasing power. So that's why they're like the main target of our campaigns to make sure that they're demanding green steel. And what we've found is that because of their climate commitments, which are much stronger than the steel industry's own commitments, they have a lot of incentive to clean up their steel supply chain and get rid of those emissions in their embodied emissions of vehicles. And I think the other thing that's like at play here is that while we transition to electric vehicles, there's a lot more focus publicly and among consumers in getting cleaner cars. And so the first thing to go, of course, is the tailpipe. But after that, when you're looking at embodied emissions, steel makes up, the numbers vary a lot. Maybe Chats, you have a different number here, but about 30% of the embodied emissions of a car. And so there's a huge opportunity for automakers to reduce their embodied emissions by finding a green steel product. And that's part of the competitiveness that Chats was alluding to. If companies want to get green steel and there's such limited availability, that's how we end up driving up the price, which actually makes it easier for steel companies to transition. So it's actually a little bit of a symbiotic relationship here where they can kind of encourage each other to keep cleaning up. And I think now that we have the first green steel plant announced in the United States, we're going to see that kind of catalyzing more and more investments, because once you have the opportunity to buy a green product, it just makes it that much more obvious that what you were buying before is dirty, and companies that are being saddled with that dirtier product are going to, you know, pay the price in their emissions calculations.
Great. Thanks for that. Yeah. And that reminded me too, talking about sort of these being able to say that they have green steel in their cars. That is maybe a point of confusion. Some companies now say they are using green steel. They're referring to what Chats was talking about, was the recycled scrap that's melted down in electric arc furnaces. But sort of, I guess what you're saying is sort of the true green steel is the one that comes from these, that eliminates coal altogether from the process, right?
Yeah. So the thing that I failed to mention is that the automotive industry actually needs a high purity steel for some of their applications. And so while some companies have been able to use some recycled content, and that's great, and we should encourage them to do so, there are other applications that need more iron in the final steel product for purity reasons. So the most compelling reason that I've heard is that if and when, and horrible knock on wood that you get in a car crash, you need to know how the steel is going to bend. And the more contaminants that are in it, the less likely you are to know exactly what is going to happen. And so I think that's one reason. I think there are other reasons like paint adhesion. So maybe less compelling reasons. So yeah, I think those are some of the reasons why the automotive industry is particularly interesting here.
And Edith, I was curious if you could talk about how, you know, we were talking about like customers and the supply chain are working together on the community side and the kind of resident side. How is kind of your organization, your community working with those in other steel towns or fence line communities to kind of share ideas and resources as you're kind of going up against these big industries to advocate for environmental justice, public health?
Southwest PA is very fractured. And even though Clarendon Coke Works isn't far from Edgar Thompson, or the Irvin plant isn't far from Edgar Thompson, it takes a great amount of effort and organizing to connect everybody just within the Mon Valley. I have to say, like, in terms of national movement building, not necessarily so great in Southwest PA, but there definitely have been attempts made by people and professional environmental organizations that are there. So there are a lot of small environmental organizations sometimes representing national chapters. And I think in terms of that, there's a lot of great collective work that's going on. You know, if I want to get connected to a national movement, I mostly just have to do that work myself. Even when there's been cohorts that have been put together and we'll say like financed by foundations, like it doesn't, right? Like it doesn't always lead to a lot of coalition building. And so I am hopeful there's an organization called the, their acronym is BLAC, Black, and they are the Black Appalachian Coalition, and they are located in what can be described as the Ohio River Valley. And I think I feel like I've been able to make some connections because their staff and members are part of a particular region, the Appalachia, as opposed to just like being specifically just focused in Southwest PA. But don't get me wrong, there's so much work that people have to do around every sort of injustice that you can think of in Southwest PA. It's hard to sort of lift your eyes from your own place and look up sometimes.
Thanks, Eva. Well, I was just going to ask you all kind of one final question, and then I'll open it up to Q&A. I'm not sure if we have a microphone to go around. We'll figure that out. but yeah. Well, I wanted to ask, we can go down the line starting with Edith, but thinking, you know, in the most ideal scenario, what in terms of steelmaking, cleaning it up within your communities or kind of nationally, what would you like to see happen? What's sort of the future that you want for your region or for the country? One or the other.
And how okay. Did you get there? Right, exactly. So sort of when I first started to respond, there's a lot of people where I live thinking about what their future can be. I will have to say, not most people include any part of the steel industry as part of it, but myself and other people that live adjacent to Edgar Thompson, work with Carnegie Mellon University, a School of Architecture class, and envisioning what our futures could be. And one of the exercises, one of the years is like, what would a green steel mill look like here? And I think the footprint really needs to be reduced. right? Like, is that possible? Because it certainly seems like the amount of space that they take up, most of it is not used. They also, a reduction in their legacy power, right? So U.S. Steel employs 3,000 people in southwestern PA, and the amount of power that they have is excessive.
Political power,
influence, and like all industries, it's always the only argument they have is jobs, and they've eroded their job pace. So 600 people work at ET. Three of those people live adjacent to it. Everyone else lives outside of it for obvious reasons, right? Chronic exposure at work. Why would you want to continue to expose yourself? So what would my vision? I mean, I have immediate things of how they could help, right? Like even if they built a green screen along their razor wired, you know, sort of like World War II looking fence that they have to just like make things look a little better, right? And there's tons of trees and tons of overgrowth where I live. There's lots of water. So, you know, I don't know how much it would help mitigate the pollution there, but really they need to at the very least show a commitment to the community that they're willing to follow the current regulations that exist, and that people don't constantly have to sue them. So what would it look like? The things that people ask for where I live are schools, grocery stores. These are things we don't have. So it's challenging to think about green steel and what corporations should do when you don't have these like basic necessities within the place where you live. It's a tough question to answer. Just leave it there.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
I think there was a panel on just before on sort of the same concept with oil towns and what to do there. And I think there's lots of parallels that we're facing. And a lot of it is just around, you know, deep listening and thinking about what communities are wanting, and the fact that none of these green steel plants or green anything in industry have actually been done before, right? We're kind of in the phase in the next 5 years of looking at how these plans are evolving. There's obviously lots of requirements under federal funding of community-based agreements and things like that and how to do that, but it hasn't been executed yet. And so I think there is a real chance of learning from this like next 5 years, but then also looking at overseas and what's happening. And I think to the two sort of plants that Hillary also alluded to in that, so there'll be three in the whole world. And so this is kind of a front row seat. So the two are in northern Sweden and in Boden for H2 Green Steel, where that's happening. It is a community that they went through sort of multiple years of community engagement to do this sort of asking of what folks wanted. And I think that's one. And then hopefully that is a stepping stone in terms of the new direction versus where in the US we're asking for the bare minimum of adhering to EPA regulation, which seems like, you know, sort of a, how can we not already get that right versus moving on to what do folks actually want and then going beyond, you know, jobs, clean air, et cetera, because that should just be what it is. And then thinking more long-term around, you know, new technologies, getting other indirect jobs, getting manufacturing to be sort of a hub in onto itself for steel because it is such a big industry.
Yeah, I agree with everything that both Edith and Chats have said. I think starting with community engagement and finding out what communities want seems like the right place to start. And that has not been the place that any company has started historically. So that seems like a good thing to put at the top of the list. From a climate perspective, we need to eliminate fossil fuels. And I think the good news today that we've talked a lot about is that we can. And so, you know, these industries like steel, cement, aluminum are often deemed hard to abate. And I think one of the things that I'm excited about is that I think we can retire that term. Like we have the technology and the big work to do, I think, ahead is getting, I want to say communities on board, but that makes it sound like coercion, but it's more like getting community permission to like build these facilities where needed, not building them where they're not wanted and not needed, addressing all the health concerns, and you know, bringing the industry into a modern century. I think there's a lot of work to be done also to bring workers along. This is not something that's currently being championed by the U.S. steelworkers, and I think there's a big opportunity for them to really benefit from the transition. So a lot of people, communities, public health, companies even stand to benefit from a just transition here. And so there's an opportunity to get it right. And that's, I think that's all part of the vision for green steel. It's not just about climate emissions, but about the whole picture.
Great. Thank you, everyone. So we can open it up to questions. Just some reminders that SEJ members and journalists have priority. Please identify your name and your publication. And please don't make speeches.
I'll try to keep this short. Thank you. Hi, my name's Janae. I'm a health and environment reporter with Capital B in Gary, Indiana. So great, great topics. Thanks so much. As someone kind of new to this beat, right, of covering, especially with like steel towns, do you have any advice for things to maybe watch out for, maybe like some red flags to be aware of when reporting on these kinds of topics, especially coming from things from U.S. Steel that might come off as like maybe greenwashing or like not as like is like genuine in their efforts, something that a fresher reporter might not catch at first?
I'm happy to start just because I'm obsessed with Capital B Gary. So I've been reading, if people aren't familiar, I think it's a semi-new outlet, at least in Gary, the Gary chapter. It's like an established network of Black-focused reporting, which has been very exciting in this community that is a little bit of a news desert. So very excited that you're here. You know, we mentioned briefly the carbon capture project that was announced. And the reason why I think not, I mean, that project was silly because the goal was just to do less than 0.5% of emissions. But in theory, there could be a bigger project announced in the future. And as Chats was alluding to, one of the concerns with carbon capture on these facilities is that they are very old. These are 100-year-old facilities. They require very expensive maintenance every 15 to 20 years to keep them operating safely, like in the $300 million range. And so if you're just building on top of an old facility that requires all this additional investment to keep running on coal, to me, there's a red flag there in terms of like false solutions. So we're looking for a transformative change that's actually going to get coal and other fossil fuels out of the steelmaking process. And if it's not doing that, I think that's a big red flag.
Quickly, because maybe the list is long, but certainly things around when you decarbonization as a hot topic and thinking about that of the boundary. And I take an example of SunCoke, for example, and how folks, so all incumbent steelmaking is, you know, heavily tied to coal, and then how iron making and steel making is produced. And so there is a lot of, I want to say, misinformation that can be handled by just saying, oh, we've decarbonized by X percent because now this is no longer in the boundary, but they have strong joint ventures. They are sort of intertwined within these things. And it's this more of a paper pushing exercise of how these things are made. So I think there's a lot of, I want to say, check the facts of like what exactly these things mean when they say, hey, we've actually disassociated from this. Have they, or have they just, you know, done a different partnership model? And so I think that's a sort of relatively recent announcement that came, I think, in the last 2 years of that. And it wasn't true.
What was the announcement with SunCoke, you said?
Yeah, I think that was just saying, you know, in terms of scope one emissions reductions, that just means it'll go to a scope three emissions reduction. And for those, you know, it's either direct or indirect. And I think that's a sense of cutting ties with the coal, you know, producer doesn't mean you've actually stopped using the coal. It just takes it off your sheet and puts it onto somebody else's sheet.
Let's take the next question.
Hi, Peter Fairley. I'm a freelance journalist, and I write a lot about energy and technology. Apologies if you addressed this before I got here, which was a little late. But in terms of the role, in terms of how you get coal out of steelmaking, my sense was that steel, or at least some steel, needed carbon in it. And so I thought you, one of you said that there were plants that were getting, that were already using hydrogen via natural gas. And so, you know, using green hydrogen was just a matter of swapping that in. Can you talk about, you know, how much process innovation is required and whether you do need carbon? And if so, where do you get that from?
I'm going to say the percentage of carbon that gets re-added into steel is not a major sort of bottleneck within that. Sort of clean sources, I think, that are happening in Hybrit at the moment, which is the green steel plant that's, I think, in demonstration, about to be commissioned in a couple of years, is using sort of biomass-based carbon sources. So I think there is, you know, when we think about how do you get the C, it's not just for steel, it's, you know, when we think about sustainable aviation fuels and all of these other sources of biomass in the right way, or if there's a recycling component and melting that down for carbon. So there is a volume, and, you know, how much do you need of it? Not much. And then is there other sort of renewable, sustainable sources of that? We obviously need to make sure that that is sourced in the right way, but it, you know, people are getting it now, as sort of mentioned in this plant. And I think that that becomes sort of a siting and partnership issue as well. So in Mississippi, I'm sure they've, you know, sort of paired up with the right folks to get some type of bio-based oil into that system.
Thank you so much for this panel. It's been really helpful and interesting. My name is Kylie Bentz. I'm a reporter at Inside Climate News, and I mostly report on Pennsylvania. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about hydrogen hub proposals and how those are connected or related to green steelmaking, especially the one that is proposed in Western Pennsylvania, which I believe is proposing to use blue hydrogen mainly. You know, if that proposal were to go forward using blue hydrogen, what would that mean for the steelmaking industry in Western Pennsylvania? What would be the downsides or potential benefits of blue hydrogen? And I guess in an ideal world, what would you prefer, or what do you think those hydrogen hub proposals should be doing in order to best support, you know, truly decarbonizing steel?
Sure. I'm happy to start. So hydrogen hub, my understanding, is a somewhat meaningless term. It just means that there's like a company in charge of a bunch of different projects. And so I hope that that is right, because that gives me a little bit of hope that there's an opportunity to influence the projects that are under development. So as you mentioned, a lot of the projects under the ARCH2 hub are blue hydrogen, but that doesn't preclude there from being additional projects or changing the projects to be green hydrogen. But I think that's the opportunity there. So in the initial announcement, there were no agreements with steelmaking companies to become off-takers. So it's possible that this hub really is just like not part of steelmaking, that they just don't partner with any steel companies and it's used for other things. But when the Ohio announcement came out from Cleveland Cliffs, when they mentioned that they want to transition to hydrogen eventually on a timeline, no parameters, they did name the ARCH2 hub as a potential source for that hydrogen. So I think that's one to be looking at very closely, because it could end up serving the Middletown Works new direct reduced iron plant. And it would be very concerning if they ended up getting blue hydrogen for that facility, because as Maria was mentioning, making hydrogen, period, uses energy. There's an energy loss involved. And so if you're able to not use hydrogen, that is generally a better thing to do. And so because direct reduced iron plants can run directly on gas, I've heard that there is actually some savings to using blue hydrogen because of the carbon capture involved, but it's like on the margins. And so like that would be a big concern. But the opportunity is that because there's a hub nearby, they could add additional facilities that are making green hydrogen, and those could service the Middletown Works. I think the other thing I would just say about the hubs generally and steelmaking is that there was only one hub during the announcement that mentioned steelmaking, and that was the MACH2 hub. I don't know how you pronounce it, MACH2, I think. And that's in the Midwest. And it's a partnership with Cleveland Cliffs, the same steelmaker, and they're actually trying to use hydrogen in their blast furnaces. So as Chats was talking about, like, you know, hydrogen is just the reducing agent. And so you can, there are ways to inject it into a blast furnace, but it continues the reliance on coal. And there's like a technical maximum in terms of pollution reduction. So there are a lot of concerns there, but they did actually build a hydrogen pipeline already to connect with that hub. So the first use of hydrogen in steelmaking in the U.S. is likely to be not one that's particularly helpful for climate, and that's going to be in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, I might just add, I think on the potential of these seven hydrogen hubs and the scale of them is quite small. I think this is a chance for connecting and sort of showing, can we make blue, green, whatever color of hydrogen there is, and then thinking about then how do you expand and attract and get other sort of producers or midstream players and other industry, hopefully, as we convert over to steel. Hillary mentioned, I mean, there's a maximum limit to those blast furnaces using hydrogen. And so, again, if that helps scaling some level of green hydrogen, sure, as a system optimized change, but it doesn't really get to the change, like the changes that we need to see, because you need to have an actual technical conversion of that asset, shutting down blast furnaces, getting DRIs in, and then you have to think about, you know, getting clean hydrogen, green hydrogen into those plants. So a bit sort of far off in terms of these immediate announcements in the hubs, but there's certainly opportunity to get them in.
Thank you. Well, thanks for the panel. It was super interesting. My name is Gina Jimenez. I'm a reporter, a health reporter, actually, mainly. And one thing I was wondering was about, you talked a lot about how in the U.S. there's been like this shift and like now 70% of steel comes from recycling. I was wondering how it looks like outside, in other countries. If you could talk a little bit. Thanks.
I can start. It's sort of switched. So okay. I think most folks that follow steels also know the sort of the boom that's come from China and now sort of rising in India from steelmaking, primarily from blast furnace steel. So in global steel tonnage, you know, China makes up about 50% of that steelmaking, which is not recycled steel. It's new steel because they've had mass development in the last 10 years of buildings and construction and things like that to sort of build economies there. And so as we look at emerging places in Southeast Asia, as well as sort of Northern Africa, all of these places will want to have the same facilities as we do in sort of these countries. And so that is sort of the flip and the switch, as we talk about, of it's not the same everywhere else. And there's a lot of primary steelmaking, polluting steelmaking that we'll need to think about because they're new as well. We talk about decades long blast furnaces here, but in China, they're all, you know, relatively new, under 10 years of age. So what do you do with those facilities and how do you transition?
Yeah, the other thing that I would add is that if you're like reporting globally on the steel transition, hopefully we've made clear the difference between like iron making and steel making here and like the difference between electric arc furnaces and direct reduced iron. But when you hear a global announcement about a new green steel facility, often what they mean is that they're building an electric arc furnace. And that is new and exciting. You are looking outside of the United States because that's a technology that has a lot of opportunity for growth in other economies. That was just like one thing that I would point out. And the other thing to think about with electric arc furnaces globally is that there's a global scrap shortage. There's my understanding that there's not a scrap shortage in the United States, that we have like a good system and it's kind of right-sized, but we import, right, Chats, like the highest quality of scrap. And so as more countries are building out their own ability to recycle steel, they're also going to start keeping their high quality scrap. And that's going to create a global scrap shortage, which is why it's so important to tackle the new steel that needs to be made. So yeah, it's way less, as Chats was saying, globally in terms of recycling, but that is on the rise, which is good, but creates a new problem of limited scrap.
Hi, I'm Natalie Schlickelman. I'm a student member from Bryn Mawr College, which is right outside Philadelphia. And I was wondering about sort of the stage of this steel transition that you guys are in, like in terms of like education versus pressure, like from, especially from a journalist and advocate standpoint. Obviously, both of those things have to happen sort of in tandem, but is a more effective focus at this point sort of educating the public about the fact that the steel transition exists and that like corporations that this is the thing they should be doing, or is it something that sort of most people are already aware of and it's at a point where it needs to be sort of a pressure into you need to actually start moving into this?
That's for both. Yeah. I guess it just depends on which side it is. I think in terms of like the positioning on health and opportunity and that it is now cost competitive, particularly in the US, to make this transition is something that perhaps needs education. Like I guess, you know, all of us probably more in steel than, you know, the general media, right? So I think that is as a point. And then there is the pressure point of saying, how do you actually then get this business case to work? And so that's more of a education piece for perhaps investors and EDO offices and things like that to attract this competitive business and invest in this business, because now there is, I guess, a business case to be made and people want to buy it. And so I think there's like a different side of how you can sort of get folks interested in that and advocate for the right solutions.
Yeah, I'll just add from the journalist perspective, I think that it's heavy industries can feel like a tough one to cover sometimes because there is a lot of like groundwork that needs to be laid depending on who the reader is, you know, and like, even though I think what's interesting is like, these are products, steel, aluminum, chemicals that are like infused in our everyday lives and we depend on them, but maybe generally don't think about them and how they're made in the same way we think about our electricity or our transportation. So I think like the bringing heavy industry more into the conversation and kind of making it part of the whole decarbonization is effort is a great place to start too, even if it's like, it's hard to say as a journalist, you know, like to advocate for a certain solution, but more about, okay, if we're going to be so focused on cleaning up cars and electricity, why not think about where your steel comes from? Or even, well, there was a like fun little takeaways from the $6 billion Department of Energy investment, like even ice cream factories and whiskey distilleries and mac and cheese plants are, you know, in need of decarbonization. So that's like an interesting way too, that maybe is more accessible than steel, for example.
Well, let me just humbly point out that we lose an awful lot of steel to bad recycling practices on the local level. And just made difficult for people. I mean, I came from a community where you just went to the dump and you could put your metal in one place, to a community where I have to drive all over the place to recycle my metal. So if we just could change certain practices on a local level, then we could help capture more aluminum and steel and maybe some other things. But oh, and the stuff that's in the electronics too. And this is something that is not adequately addressed. I mean, it's talked about, but it's not adequately addressed. Okay, that's.
I think we probably have time for one more question. Oops.
Right, you probably heard me right. We have time for one more question.
I had a question, Charlie Spatz with the Energy Policy Institute. I had a question about electricity supply and those new power plants, those new, the Mississippi and the Ohio green plant proposals. How much electricity would be going into those plants? Those are coming from states that don't necessarily have utilities with the best reputation of clean energy generation. What does that look like? Does it matter that much for like the modeling that you're doing on how carbon intensive the steel is?
I can start, and the Ohio one is interesting. So maybe the Mississippi one is a little easier to address on the electricity side. So as I mentioned, typical plant, sort of 4 gigawatts of renewables, massive. A lot of this in Mississippi is going to be behind the meter. And we think about behind the meter, it's going to be with, you know, this coupling with Hystor, and how they produce hydrogen is with salt caverns for storage. So they'll have their own sort of renewable mix on site, make the hydrogen and then store it. And then that'll be paired with sort of SSAB's steel facility. And so I think when we say it's not sort of relative to the utility, they'll have some connection, I'm sure, where they'll have sort of buyback and feed in, but it's behind the meter. And so other regulations on the production tax credit, for example, on alley matching and things like that, that come in sort of won't come into effect. So obviously they'll store it in the sense of when the sun is shining, put it in and then run that for 24/7 for the plant, but it won't be sort of tied to the grid. Whereas in Ohio, I imagine that there'll have to be a case, right, where you need to start thinking about essentially like how do you procure that much, and the rules around 45, you know, Y and V are sort of becoming a little bit of a bottleneck, and we can, you know, talk about that afterwards. But I think that is the sense in a barrier that's seen as not just for steel. I think for most folks that are trying to uptake on clean hydrogen now because of these regulations that are put on the utilities.
And can I just ask on a little bit down in the process of making that steel, there's additional electricity.
Mm-hmm.
What about that? Is that just coming off the grid as
yeah.
well?
Yeah.
And then how much of the electricity is that? How much how is that a serious demand for electricity for that
it is.
As well?
It is. Yeah. And so currently there's different programs, as I kind of alluded to, on kind of getting PPAs and things like that to match. A lot of the recyclers at the moment that use scrap-based steel, like Nucor is obviously operating a lot of EAFs at the moment, and that's the clean steel angle. They'll go for that as well, of saying it's paired up with EAC or a REC market. So it is a significant amount of electricity. There's programs involved to try and procure that for them. But yeah, it's certainly, I think, a double prong of having to get off.
Just one more.
Yeah.
With the procurement there, for those two announcements, was there any PPAs announced at all for okay.
It's not a PPA, but they have a letter of intent from Hystor Energy to provide the green hydrogen in Mississippi.
But on the general electricity.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess these announcements, while it's exciting, like we're at sort of stage zero, right? They're at, you know, 2029 is meant to be when they're going to be sort of in commissioning stage. So I think there's, you know, a window for them to, like, when they will start getting these types of deals.
Yeah. And maybe just to end with like a shocking and unverified number, which I think is probably something journalists appreciate. But our back of the envelope math on like how much renewable energy is this going to require to transition just the existing steel capacity in the United States, ballpark 35 gigawatts. So if you're working on renewable energy build out, we need everything you can do.
Great. Well, thank you so much to the panelists. I really appreciate you making your way to Philadelphia and spending your time with us to talk about green steel. I'm going to put, I don't know how useful this is, but on the FUBA app in the comments, the full link to the video that Edith shared and some infographics that kind of break down how steel is produced, kind of traditional coal-based hydrogen and sort of the scrap-based steel too, just so you can visualize that. But yeah, thank you again for coming out, coming all this way upstairs too. I appreciate it.